Chapter 17. The Crown Prosecution Service eventually contacted me about the Anthony Pearson case. His girlfriend, Teresa Lazenby, had been charged with murder, and her trial was shortly to take place. There was a pre-trial meeting, a luxury Simpson enjoyed throughout his career, but which I have seen disappear in the course of mine. And before it, I refreshed my memory with the notes and photographs of the case. Prosecuting counsel had also sent me some more material, including transcripts of Teresa's police interviews. As I read, I remembered how the detectives who interviewed her had found it hard to connect the strangled body of an adult male with that young woman, how protectively they had spoken about her. I soon began to understand why. In the interview, Teresa explained that she had known Anthony for 5 years. She had a 4-year-old daughter by him who lived with her parents. She divided her time between the flat she shared with him, where she usually spent her nights, and her parents' house nearby, where she spent her days. At the time of Anthony's death, Teresa's parents and daughter were away on holiday. She described the day in detail, and I can only say that it was a very ordinary day that ended in a very extraordinary way. The juxtaposition of the two was almost surreal. She bought a birthday card for a friend and video recorded a TV show for her absent family, went to her grandmother's to ask after her grandfather who was poorly. She tried unsuccessfully to borrow a little to help pay for a holiday she planned with friends in Tenerife. So far, so normal. Later she met Anthony at the pub. He was drinking heavily and strangely annoyed with her for arriving early. He did not approve of the holiday, you slag, and then demanded money to buy more drinks and then for cannabis. Teresa borrowed money for Anthony from her occasional boss behind the bar. A complicated evening of drinking, cannabis and anger followed. Teresa herself consumed only one half of lager and no cannabis, and her description of events showed her as the appeasing girlfriend of a very erratic and difficult lad. By the time they arrived home with a takeaway pizza, her statement suggested he was out of control. I gave him his pizza in the front room, and he said he'd lost the cannabis, and I said, "Don't be silly." So I started searching through his pockets, and he pushed me away against the wall. He threw 2 glass ashtrays at the wall, and I said, "You always have to break things," and he said, "Yeah, that's right." He just freaked out, and he started pulling the videos off the mantelpiece and throwing things around. He was shouting, and he started pulling the record player apart. And I went to hold him to stop him doing it anymore, crying. And he punched me in the head and I fell over and I cut my hand. Shows palm of right hand cut. And there was glass all over the place. And I was lying by the sitting room door and he couldn't open it because my head was there, so he kept banging my head with the door. He went into the toilet and he was calling me, and so I went in, and he cut his arm with a razor blade on purpose. I got a towel and I said, "Don't be silly." I got a towel and put it around his arm. I think it was his right arm. I think he flicked the towel off first. Then he pulled the string out of the light socket. I went in our bedroom, and he was throwing more things, my little ornaments. He went into the kitchen. I've got a glass dining table, and I said, "Please don't smash it." But he picked up some salt and pepper pots and went into the bedroom and threw them out of the window. And he picked up the mirror. So I closed the window, and I grabbed him, and we both fell back on the bed, sobbing, and I was holding him. He cut my arm. I don't know what it was, but I moved my arm. Shows right forearm cuts. I moved my arm, and he elbowed me in the stomach. I put my arm over again. He cut and bit my arm. Shows cuts and bruising, right upper arm. I picked up a piece of tie at the side of the bed, sobbing. It was on the bedside cabinet on the left side. And I just strangled him with it. I didn't want to hurt him. I just wanted to stop him hurting me. I just didn't know. I just didn't want him hurting me any more. I was shouting at him to leave me alone, to get off me. "Get off me! Get off me!" Then when he stopped hitting me, I ran out of the house and came here. Q, when you were strangling Tony, were you on top of him on the bed, or him on top of you, or side by side? Which was it? A. We was near enough side by side. I was on the left side of the bed. I was on my back. He was on my leg below me. I wasn't trapped. He hit me in the stomach a few times. I got the tie around his neck, sobbing. Q, carry on. A. I crossed the tie over. I pulled it tight to stop him hitting me. I don't know how long for, but when he stopped punching me, I ran out of the house and ran here. Q. Did you mean to kill him? A. Sobbing. No, I didn't want to kill him. Q. Did you think you'd killed him? A. I knew I'd hurt him because he kept trying to catch his breath. He went purple. His mouth, his tongue. His tongue was sticking out. I looked at him. I knew I hurt him. I just had to get out of the house. I had to get here to get help for Tony. I told the man straight away, the policeman. Teresa went on to say that Tony had assaulted her in the past, but, amid much sobbing, that she loved him and felt he needed her. It seemed she was a very young mother. She and Tony must have had the baby when they were still in their teens, trapped in an abusive domestic relationship by her belief that he needed her. I was moved by her protests, her insistence that this was the first time she had retaliated, and then only under immense physical threat from Tony. Sometimes perpetrators seem more like victims, and Teresa was both suffering and remorseful. But the prosecution was planning to rely on my evidence, which had to be unbiased. So I was determined to adhere to the truth with its beautiful simplicity and not allow emotion with all its treachery to muddy that simplicity. The case conference was held in one of the Crown Prosecution Service rooms above the Old Bailey. The courtrooms are majestic and wood-panelled. There is no court in the UK that gives participants more of a sense of justice, its history and importance, than Court One of the Old Bailey. There is nothing majestic, however, about the offices above. I waited in a room with battered furniture and ill-fitting windows, and suddenly counsel, a senior and a junior, burst in. They had come straight from their case in the court below, still wearing their gowns, throwing their wigs on the table, greeting me by name before the more formal proceedings began. The two detectives arrived shortly afterwards. Spending time at a post-mortem together can be a bonding experience, and we shook hands warmly like friends. We sat around a large, scratched table drinking tea from china mugs. Barristers didn't do polystyrene, with the various files and photographs spread out before us. All of the Metropolitan Police photographs were put into small folders with stiff brown covers bound by black plastic rings. I was silent as everyone else discussed Teresa Lazenby's plea. The charge was murder, but they thought it was highly likely that her counsel would offer a plea of guilty to manslaughter with diminished responsibility, which, of course, carried a much shorter sentence. The detectives were keen that this would be accepted. It was obvious that they liked Teresa and that they believed she had acted in self-defense. Indeed, unusually when the defendant has been charged with murder, they had not even objected when she was released on bail. "Have you read her police interview, Dr. Shepherd?" senior counsel asked me. "Yes." "And you've seen the pictures of what he did to her before she grabbed the tie?" asked the detective. "No, I didn't receive those pictures." There was a lot of shuffling, and then the barrister produced a folder. The police photo folders I usually saw contained pictures of murder scenes and of post-mortems. This folder was different. From the pages stared a pretty young woman who was very much alive. "So," I said, "this is Teresa." Her youth and health lit up the pictures. She was fresh-faced, and her long red hair was sensibly tied back. Just as the detectives had told me all those months ago, she was rather sweet-looking, a world apart from the usual murder suspect. I carefully examined each photo while everyone else sipped their tea and chatted. Finally, I looked up. I said, "I think..." Then I paused. Was I sure? I did not want to be blinded by any preconceptions of the case into forgetting the horrific consequences of a mistake. The police officers watched me intently, waiting. The lawyers frowned. The pause went on too long. "Yes," prompted senior counsel, in a tone that indicated my hesitation could be jeopardizing the credibility of what I was about to say. Then I remembered that nagging doubt I had felt on the day of the post-mortem. It was caused, even then, by a dissonance between fact and story. And now I had found another major divergence between the truth and Teresa's version of it. "Yes, I was sure," I said. "I think all Teresa's injuries are self-inflicted." Counsel for the prosecution gaped at me. "What? She did all these things to herself." His junior colleague reached for the photos. Those cuts on her arm, you're saying she made them? I believe so. I do not believe that she killed Anthony Pearson in self-defence, because he was attacking her with glass, razors, what have you. They exchange glances. You'll say that in court? Yes. I'd like more time to study this case, of course. How? The detective inspector was unshockable, but he looked miserable. How can you be so sure that Tony Pearson didn't cut her? In fact, the injuries in the pictures bore all the classic hallmarks of self-infliction. If you're being attacked, you get out of the way, twist, move, do something. You can't help it. Unless you're being pinned down, which Teresa says she wasn't, or you're immobilized by drugs or alcohol, which she clearly wasn't, then you simply don't let someone slice your skin over and over again, in the same direction and in the same place. And there was further evidence. The wounds were only in the most common sites for self-inflicted injuries. The sites are common because they're easily accessible, and the force used was only moderate. It's not hard to be forceful when you're in a fury and cutting someone else. It's very difficult if you're injuring yourself. I explained all this. These certainly weren't defense injuries, I said. The two barristers looked at each other again, and then at the police officers. I noticed once more that, although the detectives had charged her with murder, it was clear they liked Teresa. One of them picked up the folder containing her pictures. Look at her face. Tony Pearson must have scratched her there, he said. I shook my head. No, these are fingernail injuries. I held a hand up to my own face and mimed scratching it in exactly the same way, in exactly the same place. If I remember rightly, the victim's fingernails were bitten down. They were far too short to make these scratches. I reached for the post-mortem folder. The notes I had made at the post-mortem were attached, and as I moved them, the air became lightly scented with that smell, its pungency like snapped elder branches of the mortuary. I flicked through the folder rapidly until I found a picture in which Anthony's fingers were clearly visible. Yes, he obviously bit his nails. They wouldn't have been sharp enough to inflict the scratches to her face. I handed it over. The detective studied it and passed it to senior counsel, who put on his glasses to peer closely before dropping it in front of junior counsel, who glanced at it with difficulty and then shut the book rapidly. I picked up the pictures of Teresa. On the other hand, I held one up in which her fingers were visible. Her nails are cut to a sensible length, but she could certainly scratch her own face with them. They passed it around, then there was a silence. And the bite mark on her arm? Demanded the first lawyer. She could reach her upper arm with her own mouth. I demonstrated, not very ably, by biting at my own arm. Then I opened the photograph folder again. And look carefully, the size of the bite marks indicate a small mouth, too small for a man. We can confirm that by measuring her mouth, of course, but we need to get a forensic odontologist to examine her. Bite marks are highly individual. There was another silence. I did notice in your statement, I said, turning to the inspector, that when Teresa appeared outside the police station, you initially called an ambulance, and then, when we examined the injuries, we cancelled it, he agreed. Because you didn't think they were too serious, I reminded him. Counsel asked, did you come here today expecting to tell us this? I hadn't seen the pictures, but I certainly intended to tell you that Teresa's version of events could not be true. I knew that when I read the transcript of her interview. The prosecution lawyers were looking excited, while the police officers were assuming the weary expression of those who suspect they have been duped. I was confident, at least partly because I had discussed this evidence with my colleagues back at Guy's, and we were all in agreement. I knew from the ligature marks that she could not have put the tie right around his neck, crossed it, and pulled it tight as she described. The tie did not go right around his neck. It did not cross. It went only across the front of his neck. I said, at first, I thought she must have strangled him from behind by pulling on both ends of the tie, but she's given this very accurate description of his face as he was being strangled. She did say she was at the front of him. That, at least, I believe. But if she did it in the way she describes, then a conscious adult male could have easily stopped her. They waited. A detective, his face puzzled, murmured, so how? Tony Pearson was very drunk, not far off three times the legal drink drive limit for alcohol. Also, he'd smoked cannabis, which would have magnified the effect of the alcohol. The most likely scenario is that he was lying on the bed, incapacitated. I think she must have simply held the tie across the front of his neck and pressed down. And he must have been too drunk to struggle. There's a good case for saying that he was face down, that she ran the tie under his neck and simply pulled back on the two ends. But then, she wouldn't have been able to describe his face so accurately as he died. The lawyer leaned forward. Are you telling us there was no fight in the flat? That she made it all up to justify the fact that she just... I think there was an argument in the flat. The neighbours heard something, after all. But it was on nothing like the scale she describes. There is no evidence that she was a victim of physical violence and that her action was self-defence. On the contrary, I believe that she must have strangled him when he was unconscious or barely conscious, then self-inflicted her injuries. Everyone looked at everyone else. No way do we take manslaughter for this one, said senior counsel. This is murder, and we're not going to let her get away with self-defence either. We shook hands and went in our different directions. The trial was scheduled for a few weeks' time, and we would next meet in court. In my earliest court appearances, I had been so nervous that I had only been able to stare back at whichever barrister was asking me questions. Or sometimes, if feeling bold, I'd looked at the judge. Ian West once came to watch me in the witness box. Afterwards, in the pub, he said, "So, who needs to believe you and understand your evidence?" In typical Ian fashion, he answered his own question before I could. "Not counsel, that's for sure. Counsel knows what you're going to say, and he knows what he's going to try to make you say. As for the judge, you're not really in the business of convincing him either. The jury..." Ian nodded his huge head. "The jury, Dick," he rasped in his Scottish accent. "The jury. Don't forget the jury." Of course, he was right. In court, Ian was in his element. 12 Good Citizens, and the public and press gallery too, was his idea of an audience, and he never failed to play to them. I am simply not an actor and could not do courtroom drama any more than I could do emotional, loving husband. However, I did try to learn from Ian. I studied him in the Old Bailey, how he listened to counsel's question, thought for a moment, turned to face the jury, paused to take a deep breath and place his hands on the edge of the witness box, from which position they could make extravagant gestures, and then replied to the question as though the jury had asked it. His eyes ran constantly over their faces. He delivered his words with aplomb. For the jury, it must have been like having the entire Royal Shakespeare Company in their living room. There was no way I could emulate Ian's performance, but by the time the Lazenby case came up, I was turning to the jury as much as I could. Since I'm in court to offer scientific evidence and not to pass judgment, I tried then, and try now, not to look at the defendant. But in those early years, I sometimes failed to control my curiosity. I couldn't resist the urge to see the person accused of the heinous crime whose effects I had witnessed. I was often amazed at how nondescript most murderers seemed. So many looked like that mild-mannered individual you barely notice sitting next to you on the train until he obligingly picks up your ticket if you drop it. As I stepped up into the witness box in Regina versus Lazenby, I found myself sneaking a glance at the defendant. I saw a young woman who, as in the pictures taken immediately after the murder, was pretty, fresh-faced and alert. Her red hair hung in a neat and charming ponytail. When I gave evidence, her eyes glistened with tears. Her lawyer passed her a tissue. She dabbed at her cheeks and bowed her head. I saw members of the jury stare at her with compassion. How could this small, delicate woman be one of the UK's very few female stranglers? How could she have carried out this act in cold blood and then had the presence of mind to inflict false injuries all over her body before presenting herself tearfully at the police station? It seemed impossible. I almost doubted my own conclusions. Nevertheless, I held firm under cross-examination, and I learned later that the pathologist instructed by the defence to review my findings and opinions did not contest my report. He agreed that at least some, or even most, of Teresa's injuries were self-inflicted. The prosecution was insistent, based on my evidence, that Teresa had simply strangled her boyfriend when he was either unconscious or too incapacitated to struggle against her. All the indications were that Teresa had not needed to defend herself against the extremely drunk Anthony. But it was hard for anyone to believe a woman so sweet and remorseful could have done such a thing unless to save her own life. It was certainly hard for the jury to believe. They accepted her plea of self-defence and found her not guilty. Teresa's lawyers had successfully persuaded them that the prosecution had failed to prove their case beyond reasonable doubt. Beyond reasonable doubt is a high hurdle to jump, but the one that I would want applied if ever I found myself on the wrong side of the dock. Despite this, I was surprised when Teresa walked free from court. I knew that, through me, Anthony Pearson had spoken, but it was also patently clear that the jury had not listened. I felt they had ignored the evidence, and their verdict was simply a vote of sympathy for an allegedly abused woman. Jen raised her eyebrows that evening as I talked about the case extensively and from the heart. I explained how a woman I believed to be a murderer had just walked free. I suspected her youth and beauty were factors in her acquittal, and that seemed unfair. Well, it makes a change from a pretty young woman being the victim, Jen pointed out. She was baffled by her unemotional husband's rather emotional response to this court case. Even I was starting to feel uncomfortable at trespassing into an anger zone I usually avoided. I better pull myself together, I said. I can't get upset like this about every court case that goes the wrong way. And of course, I did pull myself together. The Lazenby case was probably the last time I allowed myself any emotional involvement in the outcome of a trial. It's my job to ascertain the scientific truth. I tell the jury that truth. They have the right to do with it what they will. After all, they hear all the statements and details of a case, which I seldom do. I now desire no further involvement once I have offered the facts. So, no more emotional payloads for me. No more sneaking a look at the defendant or grilling police officers on the outcome of a trial. Very often, I'm not informed of the verdict when I've given evidence in a case. If I don't spot reports in the newspaper, then I have to ask police officers or other colleagues who might have been involved. After the Lazenby trial, I decided never again to ask. I would be indifferent to the verdict and restrict my interest to my own evidence. I must feel no crusading zeal to see perpetrators behind bars, and no emotional need for the jury to vindicate my findings. Let Ian West put his heart and soul into his court performances and then suffer personal devastation if the jury found against his evidence. From now on in the witness box, I would perfect the art of emotional detachment I had learned in the mortuary. I told Jen this and she looked sad. More detachment, she said. It's your answer to everything. I shouldn't let myself care about verdicts. I'm sure that's right, I said. Jen shrugged. It was interesting watching you talk about that case with so much passion. Maybe you should do it more often. I shuddered. Passion. I certainly didn't want to feel that at all, let alone more often. It was the sort of thing that could get you into a lot of trouble.